ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the February 10th edition of Warrior Connection. I'm Dr. Doug Rocky, your host. Again, I'll be joined again by Denise Nichols and hopefully some other individuals who we've requested to join us tonight. You know, we're all looking for respect, and the key thing that we have to do is make sure the Department of Defense and Department of Veteran Affairs give us respect. Right now, Republican Jeff Miller, who is now chairing the House Veterans Affairs Committee, again, has made it very clear that he wants the VA, the Veterans Business Benefits Administration, the VBA, to speed up the claims process. We got a million backlog there. It's a mess. The efficiency is very, very poor, and that can't continue. I mean, it's just a nightmare that has to end. But in order for that nightmare to end, what we have to have happen is both the U.S. Army, the Navy, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, the Marines, they have to admit, along with the VA, the incredible health, adverse health effects of all the toxic exposures that we're seeing across all combat operations, seeing during training, seeing during research, seeing manufacturing development. It's just turned into a total, complete nightmare. And once more, we're seeing again last week where they're deciding or trying to say that there are no adverse health effects from the burn pits and all the complex toxic exposures. Well, you have a burn pit exposure, have a hazardous materials exposure, the same thing. Way back in 1999, we wrote a manual for CHPM, which is the Army Center for Health Promotion and Preventive Medicine and everything, of at Fort Detrick, that outlined all the health effects from all these complex toxic exposures. We've seen it before. We've testified at the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine. We discussed it at the Center for Disease Control, and we're just still trying to get all done. But what you have happening, even though the internal memorandum totally confirmed the health effects from these exposures, you see the same thing in the VA and the military trying to disavow any connection. Well, they did the same thing with depleted uranium again this week. On Wednesday, the U.S. Army Department of Defense, working with the Canadians, came out with another report stating very specifically that they did not find any adverse health effects from depleted uranium. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been there from the beginning, and it's going to be there until we continue on, and it's a total nightmare. Denise, have you joined us tonight?
Yes, I have, and before we get too much further along in the program, just a general FYI announcement. It is on February 28th at the Illinois State Military Museum in Springfield at 11 a.m. They are recognizing and holding a ceremony to honor those who served in the 1991 Gulf War. The State Veterans Affairs Director, Erica Borgen, will speak. It tells the story of the Illinois National Guard. But wanted to get that out. That's up in your area of the country, Doug. And then we can go back to the other discussions.
Yeah, Springfield, Illinois is located in the center of Illinois. It's basically at the intersections of Interstate 72 and Interstate 55. And the Illinois Military Academy, or the National Guard, you know, again, Camp Lincoln, is located on the north part of Springfield, right in the very northern part of Springfield, not very far from, you know, everything else up there. You got Lincoln Memorial and everything else in his tomb. So that's all in the same area in the north part of Springfield. So individuals, if you're interested in doing that, obviously you can come up Interstate 55 from down in the St. Louis area, or come down Interstate 55 from the Chicago area. You got Interstate 51 that runs north and south up to, again, then Interstate 29 up towards Rockford in that area. Or you come up from 51 from the south, or again, there's a whole bunch of ways. But that, again, is where that's located. First, I'd heard about it, so that's going to be on February 28th, you said?
Yes, February 28th at 11 a.m. at the Illinois State Military Museum.
Okay, well, that's something we'll have to look into.
It will be. Hope that you can go, Doug, and connect with other Gulf War veterans there in Illinois. We really need to work at connecting our veterans within each state to work together to help each other. And we have Facebook groups, like you know, but as you know, you don't have the wireless connection, so it's very hard with a dial-up. So that's one problem the Gulf War veterans deal with. The other problem is that a lot of Gulf War veterans don't really have a laptop or a desktop, and they may have a smartphone that they're trying to get information from. So they're at a disadvantage, and we need to look at how we can work together to get veterans connected better. I know there's nonprofits that make reconditioned laptops and computers available, and so maybe we can get a group of vets to look into that, and we'll find vets that don't have a computer and get them a computer so they can start networking. I know that if they get into the VA system, I know a lot of Gulf War vets have been issued an iPad. And, you know, you can check with Evoke Rehab to see if there's a way you can get involved to have some rehabilitation and have the network available to you. They're doing all kinds of things to try to get vets employment from home, set up their own home businesses. So there's ways out there, and we need to discuss that and share those little tips with people to try to get more of our Gulf War veterans connected and the family members. Another thing that I kind of started today, and as you know, I connected with the Civilian Chronic Fatigue Group and multiple chemical sensitivity groups as soon as I figured out what was happening to us back in 92, 93. And gathering from them what they had, because they were a little bit ahead of us in getting organized and fighting for care. And a lot of them have set up blogs. And so I just set up two Facebook pages today, one to list radio talk show blogs and our normal radio program every Sunday, so that as we get people doing these things, that there's a place you can go and find out about it. And if you get on to starting a blog talk radio, there was an individual last night that had done that. So I ended up late at night for 30 minutes being a call-in guest. I know Mary Ann Parker over in Florida has one that she acted with on blog radio. And ours is nationally through normal radio channels. So we need to start getting out there more, either through radio programs or veterans. The blog, you can do it yourself. Set up a blog and talk about what you're going through, what your family's going through. It's good therapy in a way. And you're sharing with the world out there. And I really have seen it kind of developing and coming along. Chronic fatigue groups have a lot of individuals that blog about their illnesses. And they may blog once a week, twice a week, you know, whatever they feel up to, but they're sharing information of what they have done to help themselves, sharing knowledge, sharing education, sharing new studies, and talking about it. And there was, oh gosh, in the last month or two, what really brought this to a head for me to start putting it on the list and getting people to do it. And our, you know, our parent that went to a veteran suicide, this would be great for him and his family to increase awareness. But there was a show, had the TV on, and I can't remember the program that it came up on, but it was a child that died of a rare illness. And the parents, the mother, I think, was the one that set up the blog and started talking about going through this as their child had this illness, heartfelt stuff. And, you know, there were so many people that subscribed to her blog to read it. And the network news, you know, saw it. And one of the talk show programs on the TV brought up about this incident that the child's died now. So they're continuing on for a way to promote awareness. And that's a way to get the public involved. And you never know, you know, you need to publicize your blog and all, but that may be a way to open up the eyes of the nation of what people are going through, the real struggles, and possibly to end up being interviewed on a talk show, which helps awareness. And those are the things that we have to think about doing. We're doing our bit with this show every week, and we're grateful to Gary Knowles that, you know, set up this radio network and setting up programs on various things. Ours is mainly around the warrior, the Gulf War veterans, the Iraqi veterans, and speaking about that. But we need to each know that each of us, not just Doug Roeke or Paul Sullivan or Anthony Hardy, can help have an impact. And it not only helps have an impact in your sharing and other people connect to you and learn through you, but it puts the pressure back up there to get this noticed. We cannot be quiet. We have to find ways to become activists. And any Gulf War veteran, any family member that's going through this and writing about it, it's good therapy. You know, you can feel positive about doing something good. So I know we have, and I tried to get in touch with one person, his name's Scott. I wanted him to call in on one of our programs. He had a pulmonary embolism. Scott, have you called in? I don't hear him. But on the hypercoagulation with the Gulf War illness, he is very lucky to be alive. The hypercoagulation can cause embolism, strokes, heart attacks. It's a blood clot. David Bloom with the Bloom Mobile. You know, as we watched the invasion of Iraq in 2000, what was that, three? And saw him behind all the massive invasion and him back on the Bloom Mobile sucking down sand. The sand itself, are you there, Doug?
Yeah, I am.
The sand itself, as we learned from Dr. Creamy Bob, and his family. He had other family members that were scientists. But he looked at the sand, and it had a high silica content. So, you know, you have to look at silicosis. You have to look at what that could do, much less the DU.
Well, one of the problems that Andres identified right off the bat, and this, you remember, Andres was our colonel on our team with the Bowers Raiders during Desert Storm. He is a physician. So he was one of the senior colonels, senior doctors on the Bowers Raiders, and we worked directly for 3rd MedCom and then, you know, Pagonis and Schwarzkopf, the whole shebang. But he identified all this stuff right off the bat, and we started seeing the problems, and he was trying to direct medical care while we were still in theater. So we're seeing a complex mixture of the hazard materials, depleted uranium, all the chemical and biological agents, combined with the sand that was being blown all over theater. So again, incredible problems, the silicosis problems, again, which goes known forever, again, was identified and put there, you know, right in the very beginning. So
and
that's, Andres
that
brought that
DU,
all up, and, you know, Andres has gone
DU
to the heaven
on,
now.
And to have DU on top of that, and the small DU particles that end up in the sand.
Correct. Depleted uranium on Vimpac, we're looking at submicron. One of the things that we learned when we did the depleted uranium test at Nevada and worked with Aberdeen and Picatinny and Fort Detrick and everything is that very simple. The gas mass and everything protect down to about 0.4, 0.5, 0.6 micron. Well, we're looking at the particulates from the DU impact, you know, a fraction of that, a hundredth of that, a tenth of that. And so it just goes right through the mask. And again, that's what happened to all of us when we did the research and actually did, we wore the best equipment possible. And we all came down sick with the respiratory problems and everything else, and then obviously the cancers and continued on. So it's just been a nightmare. Demasio, have you been able to call in by chance? Okay.
Okay, Doug, why don't we talk about the DU study from Canada? I'll let
okay.
you lead on that.
On what happened on Wednesday, I got another email from another one of our nurses on our team and said that the study had been released from Canada on depleted uranium, and they had referred to it very specifically. Again, the group of individuals involved in up there that were on the study were never involved in anything that I know of with depleted uranium. They didn't work with us at all in medical care, didn't work with us at all in recovery operations. The only individual that they did have involved in this goes back to our old buddy, U.S. Army Colonel Dr. Eric Daxson. And Eric was not involved during Desert Storm with any of depleted uranium, although he should have been. But unfortunately, he didn't do it and wasn't there, so I got the task in to do that. However, when we did come back, we started writing all our reports, and then finally, after we did the original briefing for the Department of Defense at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, I guess that was the end of January, early February of 1992, that led into the formation of the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute study. Okay, and that was a directive that we came out for us to do this, and we started the study. That was, again, put out December of 1992, and Assistant Secretary of the Army Bobby Walker had issued this directive to us, and again telling us to look at everything else very specifically. This is what we were ordered to do. Quote, conduct a study on the health and environmental consequences of depleted uranium on the battlefield, remediation technologies which might be developed, and the ways in which the toxicity of depleted uranium might be reduced. Please note that depleted uranium is fully supported by the Army as an item that gives the American soldier the winning edge on the modern battlefield. Thus, it is important to realize that the use of depleted uranium is carefully compared against other materials which are determined to be superior. So it was a direct thing from there. We started the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute study report in December of 1992. I was already there working for CERO, the Army Corps of Engineers, cleaning up the hazard materials mess and non-compliance with NEPA when we got this stuff. Well, that's when I first met Eric Daxon, because all of a sudden, Eric, you know, we'd already communicated, and then he showed up, and we started the study at the AAPI study. What got very interesting on this stuff is while we're doing the study, we're putting everything together, but Colonel Dr. Eric Daxon put out at this time, this is March of 1993, Protocol for Modern Gulf War Veterans with Embedded Depleted Uranium Fragments. And the decision of the directive was at that time to leave the dew shrapnel in place in the body, very clearly. And we came back again, and very specifically what they wanted to do was very quote, and I want to read this for directly verbatim. Denise, you've got a copy of the report. You and I included this in a report to the United States House of Representatives when we did that. When that was in what, March of 2001?
Yeah, I think that was when it was.
Quantification and documentation of toxicological heavy metal toxicity and radiological cancer and tissue necrosis risks of embedded uranium fragments by, one, measuring and documenting uranium levels in each soldier using in vivo and in vitro measurement techniques. Determine the parameters and models needed to translate uranium levels in the body into estimates of increased cancer risk from this exposure. Three, comparing the clinical course of the body's response to DU fragments with that of other non-DU fragments to determine whether clinical significant differences exist due to either the chemical or radiological properties of depleted uranium, and four, determining the risk of chronic kidney toxicity due to long-term chronic exposures to elevated levels of uranium. Well, in my own case, they didn't tell me and didn't take care of me, and as you know, and Denise, you've been right there with me, and I've had so many kidney surgeries, it's incredible, as did the other members of our team. The other thing that what Eric put out very clearly in this directive is that when they're measuring uranium excretion, we are measuring excretion based on how many micrograms of uranium do you have per liter of urine, okay, on a day. And so when you look at it, the average output, I mean, Denise, you're the super nurse here. A person, what, excretes maybe 3 to 4 liters of urine per day?
Well, if I remember from my old memory bank here in my brain, is in intensive care, we monitor, and you've got to have at least 30 cc's of urine if you have them catheterized per hour, if
okay.
I'm remembering correctly. If we started seeing declines in their urine output with their catheter in, we got very concerned about blood flow to the kidneys.
Yeah, you started to get concentration urine and everything else.
Yeah.
Blentow, in this directive, again, the AFRI 93-2, it was very clearly that if you started excreting anything greater than 14 to 50 micrograms of, maybe 14 to 50 micrograms of uranium per day, you needed a medical care quarterly. When you exceed around 50 to 250 micrograms total excretion in a day, you need monthly urine potential for onset of kidney toxicity. And if you excrete anything greater than 250 micrograms of uranium per day, you've got to be in continuous weekly testing and, again, kidney toxicity. And as you know from my own medical records and our teams that we did get done, I was excreting at 5,000 micrograms per liter of urine, so I was up in the ballpark of 15,000 a day. And extraordinarily problems, and again, we were seeing all of the problems, so again, you know, disavowing any connection with all of this stuff. When we looked at the Canadian report, we found out rapidly that not only did they not refer to any of the medical directives that we put in place, they didn't refer to any of the very specific, and I want to quote this, very specific medical order that General Eric Shinseki, now Secretary of U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, issued in August of 1993. They didn't look at the medical directive from October 1993 because what had happened, they weren't testing anybody. And when they did test them, as you know, in my own case, came out of the field during the Nevada project, they tested me and never told me for 2.5 years. So again, we're seeing the continuous problem. In the Canadian report, they cite very specifically, again, the brand new report. Well, and now it's almost a year old now, that Colonel John Gingrich put out, where he said they were testing 79 individuals, had been following 79 individuals for depleted uranium. And I want to come back to that direct quote from him. 79 individuals. 79 veterans documented to have been followed every 2 years since 1993. Well, we know that didn't happen because they started out with 30 and everything else. They were refusing to follow anybody else. We had a general GAO report, GAO NSIAD 0070, understanding health effects of depleted uranium evolving but safety training needed. And again, this is GAO findings, and at that time they were citing the total number of individuals that had actually been tested or been involved was 51 individuals. And that was only after hearing my work, yanking every which way but loose, trying to get those 51 individuals in there. The most frightening part of this stuff, and again, Jerry Wheat, and Denise, you know Jerry Wheat very well.
Yes.
If you remember, we were in a conference in Washington, and they had just removed the tumor out of Jerry Wheat's left shoulder with the DU inside, embedded inside the tumor. And if you remember, Colonel Dr. Daxson and Mikey Kilpatrick, our good old buddies, and all everybody else stated during that conference that Jerry had to prove that the tumor they removed from his shoulder with the DU embedded in the tumor was caused by the DU that was embedded in the tumor. And it's an astonishing finding. So again, when we look at the reports and we go through the Canadian study, there's not a single mention to Army Regulation 700-48. Not a single mention to Army Technical Bulletin 9-1300-278. There's not a single mention to Daxson's own directive of AFRIN 93-2. There's not a single mention of the Wakayama report from 2002. And what is very interesting in the Wakayama report on depleted uranium, again, this is put out by Colonel J. Edgar Wakayama, director of the Environmental Test, you know, for the Department of Defense. And in this briefing, and I'm going to pull this up so I don't miss anything because I want to make sure that I quote it very specifically. We already knew we were having the medical problems because the first cancers developed in our team within 9 months of coming back. And what we've seen in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom with the 442nd New York Military Police Units, the same throat cancer is developed in the same duration. So we had the same incubation period for our team as what was showed up in the 442nd this time around. It's frightening when you keep coming across that and the same thing all over the place. But what we do have very specifically in the Wakayama briefing for the U.S. Department of Defense, he gave it to the Pentagon, and I'm looking at the briefing right now. And Colonel J. Edgar Wakayama, Director of the Operational Test and Evaluation Command for the U.S. Department of Defense. And in there he talks about everything, what DU is and everything. It just looks like the slides that I prepared for the Department of Defense and briefed them up there way back during the DU project. Again, DU is radioactive, produces alpha, beta, and gamma X-ray. Alpha particle taken inside the body in large doses, hazardous, producing cell damage and cancer. quote, note, lung cancer is well documented. Well, again, the numbers that we have lost with lung cancer and brain cancer on the DU team is way beyond comprehension. Again, John Sitton was one of the first. We had all the guys going to keep going on. Beta particle hazardous to the skin and the lens of the eyes. Got me, didn't they, Denise?
Yep, they did.
And I definitely confirmed for radiation cataracts. I've got more surgery scheduled. I got a final date where we force the VA to approve the surgery on myself. We come on down and we continue the same thing. Quote, this is all a direct quote from the Wakayama Breeding. DU is chemically toxic. The target bone is kidney and the bone. What we do know is it causes dephosphorization and decalcification, so the teeth just degrade. They don't decay, they degrade. They just go to heck, and the same thing with the bones. And then we get osteopenia and osteoporitis, again, being treated for that. The other frightening thing is, again, in the briefing from Wakayama, urine samples containing uranium are mutagenic as determined by the Ames test. Don't pee on your fingers, ladies and gentlemen, it's carcinogenic. The cultured human stem bone cell line with DU is also transformed and the cells become carcinogenic. And again, this is where the leukemia is showing up, all of the incredible problems we're having in all of bloodborne. Confirmed not only in the U.S. military, but confirmed all over in Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, the Balkans. It's confirmed over here in Jefferson Proving Ground in Indiana. Confirmed down in Vieques, Puerto Rico, and in Hawaii. We continue on the same thing. We got all the route of exposures. Quote, wounding by shrapnel, inhalation, lungs, and thoracic lymph nodes. One thing that bothered me the most about the Canadian study is they totally disregarded, and again, Denise, this is a good friend of ours, Terry Reardon, Canadian Army, who definitely got exposed and definitely died from this stuff. And if you remember, when we saw the autopsy results, they found all the uranium in the lungs and the lymph nodes, didn't they?
Yes.
So again, confirming everything, and it's just totally disregarded. The thing that makes this most disturbing to me, and again, this is from Colonel J. Edgar Wakayama, but he's basically taken the work that Denise and I did and our reports and the work I had done as director and our team had done, and quote, ingestion is another major route. Most among children playing and eating contaminated soil and water, contaminated drinking water and food in the community. Ladies and gentlemen, it's inexcusable that we go to war and use radioactive munitions against the enemy and ourselves, causing air, water, and soil contamination, refusing to provide the medical care as required by an order signed by General Shinseki not just once, but twice, refusing to comply with the directives that we have out there, and most frightening with AFRI 93-2, Colonel Dr. Eric Daxson, who again did the Canadian report, his work is not even cited, telling to leave over the shrapnel in the place. Now, again, this comes back down to it. Denise, you and I were instrumental in getting a DU friendly fire casualty up to the War Injuries Clinic in Washington, D.C., where they found all of the problems, found the embedded shrapnel, but then also in work that they end up doing, they ended up putting an MRI, moving him in the MRI, moving the DU shrapnel and paralyzing him. So, again, we have all of the problems that continue on. Again, what we do know, quote, indicated the uranium would be solubilized and redistributed to various tissues as early as 1 day after exposure. 1 day. Again, that work was done at AFRI. Again, we have all the reports. So again, we're seeing incredible, incredible problems, a continuous denial of any exposures for depleted uranium exposures. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, and again, we have talked about this before, and we have cited it. The U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs Director for Vision 11 very specifically put out a paper for the physicians identifying the health effects of all the toxic exposures, not just depleted uranium, but all of those. And in this paper, which is a directive to the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, quote, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, and this is, quote, what this is United States Department of Veteran Affairs Vision 11 booklet, Some Things You Need to Know About Veterans, a Clinician's Guide to Veteran-Specific Issues. And in there they state, quote, some of the physical symptoms which may occur as a result of exposure to depleted uranium are sleep problems, mood swings, symptoms in upper and lower respiratory system, Now, Denise, as you know, my own diagnosis from the physicians, the Army, and the VA was reactive airway disease, and we've seen that across all people. Neuropsychological symptoms, including memory loss. We've got that. Chronic fatigue, immune system dysfunction. Skin rashes. Well, you, Denise, you've helped take care of my rash before.
Yeah.
Unusual hair loss. Aching joints. Again, my joints are in aching right now. It's terrible. The weather changes have a horrible effect when we're going wet and cold and snow and ice and everything up and down. The barometric pressure changes dramatically, and the aching joints are horrific. It's, again, a basically diagnosis, fibromyalgia. Headaches, abdominal pain, sensitivity to light, blurred vision, menstrual disorders, gastrointestinal symptoms, nervous disorders such as numbness in a limb, again, and multiple chemical sensitivity and the birth defects in the children. So again, all of these problems come around. The, again, specifically identified and yet disavowed by the Canadian report, but yet they don't cite any of these reports whatsoever. On the females, Denise, you yourself are hot for depleted uranium, correct?
Right. I was tested 9 years after the war by Dr. Durakovich, and it was sent up to, I guess, Labrador. It was after the cancer, I mean, after the Canadian university, and you'll have to remember the name of the guy that was doing testing up there. But I guess they were threatened by DOD, and Dr. Durakovich lined up another place to do the testing for the urine. And it was 9 years later, and even 9 years later, it showed up a trace amount.
Yeah, and what you had had, yours was cross-contamination from the casualties that you treated on up there at Long Base Charlie
and
at the medical evacuation station.
And sandstorms.
Yeah. And one of the things, again, we're coming down because we have seen that, again, with the female disorders. Again, we've seen this thing, again, the females, again, we're looking at all the tissues and everything, all the mucous membranes and everything else. And we got to remember, the females are wide open to the environment down there in their lower end, aren't they?
Yes.
And so when you get the dust or everything, and everything penetrates right through all the uniforms and clothing, and the mop suits do not work, ladies and gentlemen. We know the mop suits didn't work. We've got the directive where the mop suits were known to be defective, and the stuff goes right through it. Because, again, we're looking at submicron. We're looking down at 0.01, 0.001 microns. Even the best gas masks we have in the Army are at 0.5 to 0.6 micron. So we're seeing all the menstrual disorders, incredible numbers. And Denise, you've worked on this where we had to have the young girls have hysterectomies in their 20s, or correct, in their 30s.
Correct. Correct. Very much so.
So we've got all of this stuff, all the gastrointestinal symptoms, again, the re-explosive diarrhea and everything. You never know whether you're going to have diarrhea or constipation. All the neurological nerveness disorders, peripheral neuropathy, again, the stumbling, the falling, and the multiple chemical sensitivity was just addressed with the IOM study. So again, the Canadian study totally disregarded everything. They didn't mention any of the fact, didn't even mention the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute study that Colonel Daxon led on. And what was interesting, and again, we presented as House representatives, we presented all over the Institute of Medicine, if you remember, Denise, Eric Daxon had me write the staff study that got General Shinseki to write the original order. Needless to say, I'm upset. And it's not so much as, again, myself and my team are affected, but what we have around the world, the United States continues to use uranium munitions. They're not going to stop using them. We go back again very simply to the Army Environmental Policy Institute study that started it out, said what we're going to do with the thing. But the other thing, too, and again, we made this available to everybody. When I was assigned to do this stuff by General Schwarzkopf by name back in the completion of the ground war in 1991, I was given two memorandum. And again, these have been posted on the Internet for everybody to read. They're out there. Again, we can provide those, make those available. The first one was Los Alamos Memorandum. This is dated 1 March in 1991, and I want to read this so that everybody understands it exactly. Studies Analysis Branch, Los Alamos, New Mexico, 1 March 1991. Subject, the effectiveness of depleted uranium penetrators. There is a relatively small amount of lethality data for uranium penetrators, either the tank-fired long version or the GAWI-8 round fired from the A-10 close air support aircraft. The recent war has likely multiplied the number of DU rounds fired at targets by orders of magnitude. It is believed that DU penetrators were very effective against Iraqi armor. However, assessments of such will have to be made. There has been and continues to be a concern regarding the impact of DU on the environment. Therefore, if no one makes a case for the effectiveness of depleted uranium on the battlefield, depleted uranium mounds may become politically unacceptable and thus be deleted from the arsenal. If depleted uranium penetrators prove their worth during our recent combat activities, then we should assure their future existence, and then parentheses, until something better is developed, through service and Department of Defense proponency. If proponency is not garnered, it is possible that we stand to lose a valuable combat capability. I believe we should keep this sensitive issue at mind whenever action after action reports are written. End quote. Now, at the same time, and this is what's driven me, I was given another memorandum, also dated from March of 1991. This came from the Defense Nuclear Agency. Okay? And there's a whole lot in here, but I'm going to read the primary paragraph. Quote, as explosive ordnance disposal ground combat units and civil populations of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iraq come increasingly in contact with depleted uranium ordnance, we must prepare to deal with the potential problems. Toxic war souvenirs, political furor, and post-conflict cleanup, that's a host nation agreement, are only some of the issues that must be addressed. Alpha particles, uranium oxide dust from expended rounds is a health concern, but beta particles from fragments of intact rounds is a serious health threat, with a possible exposure rate of 200 millirads per hour on contact. Well, as you know, what we measured is over 300 millirads per hour on contact. We're over in the tens of the hundreds of thousands of alpha emissions. And so once this gets into the body, it causes horrific, terrible health effects. And that's, again, why we set up, I was the primary advisor when we put this together for the Army Corps, Chemical Corps, as the director of the DU project, that the radio bioassay, and again, this is in the October 1993 Somalia message, must be done within 72 hours, no later than 30 days. Because of biological elimination, biological half-life, you no longer find the gross amounts in the urine. It's just sequestered in the body, so you don't find it. What we have had individuals here, and we work with the U.S. Marine that was tested, went over Cliff and Bradley, shot up with DU, a Marine officer. He tested positive right here at the Danville VA Medical Center, and he was told that his depleted uranium exposures in his urine came from the water supply in Rantoul, Illinois. It's astonishing. And, I mean, these are the things that are happening. And, Denise, you know, when you and I were asked to write the report by Chris Shays and Bernie Sanders back in March of 1991, we'd already testified many times. We'd been at the Center for Disease Control. And I distinctly remember that day when Andres Kornigbaugh and myself, again, he was a doctor on my team, were all talking about this stuff. And if you remember, we're at the CDC in Atlanta, and they wanted the briefing on depleted uranium, and Mikey Kilpatrick and Eric Daxton and Bob Cherry got up to give it. And they turned them down and said, no, Doug was the one that was there. Let him brief it. But the thing that bothers me is, and Denise, you've had this, I don't know how many times they've asked you, they've asked Bowers Raiders to come back home to work for them a lot, and all would be forgiven, correct?
Yes.
Explain a little more on that. You were the one, the intermarry.
One of the big things was at the CDC conference, and Eric was there. I'm trying to remember all of them that were there, but Kilpatrick, Eric, but one of them jumped on the elevator with me as I was going up to my room and wanted to talk to me, and sitting there telling me that they needed you back to come back across the blue line, or whatever you want to call it. The blue line is what the police call it, but come back to, you know, working inside. And it developed from there. We ended up that evening sitting there with Jim Tuitt, yourself, myself, a couple of vets, and I think we had Kilpatrick there. I'm trying to remember. But, you know, we were talking to him of Do you know how our veterans are suffering? Have you gone and met with some of the vets that are actually suffering and the disabilities they're having? Have you even called for a joint meeting to meet with them or to go to their house and meet them and see what's really happening here? Because all we were saying is we want help. We want help to get the claim through. We need help to get the actual diagnosis and testing done and treatment. And that's all we've ever really wanted to do, was get the help to the Gulf War veterans that are suffering. And now we have a bigger population.
Yeah, we're in the millions now. Now, the other thing, too, when we did the depleted uranium project, and again, the Canadian study, I had a Canadian officer specifically assigned to me as the director of the depleted uranium project. So again, General Shinseki had issued the order to develop the Army regulation, which I wrote and my team wrote, to revise the technical bulletin, which Rich Flazaro had originally written, and we modified based on the DU testing. But we wrote Army Regulations 700-48, U.S. Army Pamphlet 700-48. We wrote the Common Task Training for Depleted Uranium that is ignored. Then obviously we revised 19-9-1300-278. But along with the Canada, what we wrote is their adjoining document. And this is called the Handbook of Radioactive Materials. Again, it's dated right afterward, right at the same time. The number is C02040003TP and then three zeros. Handbook of Radioactive Materials. It was published in both English and French. And again, it talked about depleted uranium and all the hazards and safety requirements and everything associated with it. Because, again, this is showing up all the time. We have to remember, and this was a problem after the war, we had two projects that I did, the depleted uranium and the captured equipment project, and what we learned rapidly is Iraqi equipment had radioactive materials all over the place, and we had very hot radioactive isotopes that were unprotected. So when we destroyed all the Iraqi equipment with uranium munitions, we not only released all of the radioactive particulates and the contamination from the munitions, but we also released all the radioactive materials that were part and parcel of all the Iraqi equipment, which is Soviet and Warsaw Pact equipment. Again, we've seen the same thing now in Libya. We've seen it in the Balkans. We've seen the same thing in Afghanistan, and we're seeing it all over the place. So an incredible problem. One of the things, and again, in the Canadian study, they totally disregarded the Army Regulation 700-48, cited erroneous data from the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. And in this stuff, very specifically, in the handling of depleted uranium or radioactive materials, and the Army regulation is not just DU, which is uranium-234, 235, primarily 238, 236, plutonium, neptunium, and americium, but we're looking at all the radioactive contamination in the equipment and everything. In Section 2-4 of the 700-48, it very specifically set up for things that must be done. Quote, during peacetime or as soon as the operational risk permits, the Corps, Joint Task Force, Division Commanders, Radiation Safety Officer will identify, segregate, isolate, secure, and label all radiologically contaminated equipment. Procedures that minimize the spread of activity will be implemented as possible. And we continue on. One of the problems we had into is explosive ordnance disposal. The regular EOD guys aren't going on the radiological, so as you know, my team had to do that, and we lost three guys. But so you have to take care of all of this stuff, because what happens with this stuff, the explosives don't go off, and they become extraordinarily unstable, and all you have to do is bump them, and they go boom. Okay, again, very specifically, it quotes a unit, team, individual responsible for equipment, whether friendly or foreign at this time of damage or contamination, responsible for taking all action consistent with this regulation and Army Pamphlet 700-48 that I wrote. Again, General Shinseki signed it as Chief of Staff, making it mandatory. The Canadians have totally ignored it, and they even ignored their own companion document. So again, that tells you the step-by-step procedures that we developed at Nevada test site, what we developed during war and the other times, and we validated the test site. Quote, All equipment to include captured or combat radioactive contaminated equipment will be surveyed, packaged, retrograded, and decontaminated and released in accordance with U.S. Army Technical Bulletin 9-1300-278, the U.S. Army Pamphlet 700-48, and other relevant guidance. Well, we developed it. As Denise, you know, I was the guy in charge. And after I told them they could no longer use it, I became persona non grata, to say the least. I had a discussion again the other day with Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. Again, they went back to affirm very specifically that this report out of Canada was correct. When I mentioned all the other stuff, again, didn't get any place, but they referred me back to our old buddy, Dr. Mikey Kilpatrick and Craig, as the points of contact. Personal safety, quote, personal hand and contaminated equipment need to follow the personal safety measures outlined in Army Pamphlet 700-48 and Army Regulation 40-5, which deals not only with the general public, the military, but all contamination and medical care. The other thing, too, direct quote, in general, environmental impact must be considered prior to equipment retrograde. Retrograde operations must minimize the spread of contamination, preventing further harm to personnel and damage to equipment. Well, Denise, how many times have you heard and seen where the contamination has came back to the family on the equipment and the clothing?
Oh, too many to count.
Installations have we had? You and I specifically know, and we verified that the contamination did come back down in Texas.
Right.
Where we have the individuals that got sick from the exposure, correct?
Exactly. Doug, let's concentrate on the new report from Canada. Did it do anything to help? Or, you know, what do you want to get out to the public?
It didn't do anything to help at all. In fact, again, it's going back to adhering to the Los Alamos Memorandum, the December 1992 Army Environmental Policy Institute study memorandum, that there is no harm from depleted uranium. We have no responsibility for medical care. There's nobody sick or dead as a result of the exposures, and we continue to use it as we see fit.
What was one highlight quote from the Canada study that kind of summarizes it?
Okay.
Just a second. Trying to bring us, you know, full circle here since we're very close to sign-off time on the radio program today.
Okay. Let me quote. I'm finding the very beginning of the thing. Again, this is very personal because of the fact that I ordered the medical care originally that Colonel Little, you know, and the theater commander then issued the order for in June of 1991, but it just continued on. Okay. Very specifically, there is no consistent evidence from military cohort studies of adverse health effects that could be attributed to depleted uranium. Our finding that exposure to uranium is not associated with large or frequent health effects is in agreement with the conclusions of expert bodies.
Okay, so their study basically took what the U.S. government had taken out. Did they have any studies up there?
No, they didn't do anything. Again, they didn't get involved. They didn't cite anything with Terry Reardon. They cite any of Asa Durakovich's work. And again, for those people who need to know, and if you don't know by now, Dr. Asa Durakovich is actually U.S. Army Colonel Asa Durakovich. He truly was a U.S. Army's expert on uranium munitions and everything else. Also, he was a Department of Veteran Affairs physician, and he was their expert. He was the first guy that took my guys from the 144th unit that helped me clean everything up and found all the problems and the cancers and reported that. So again, what we've got, a Canadian study issued brand new, came out on Wednesday, going back and adhering to the existing orders to lie, cheat, and steal and avoid all liability by disavowing any connection between health effects, and yet they didn't cite any of the primary studies, any of the orders, the directives. They didn't cite anything other than what they wanted that would affirm their preconceived conclusion, which is, if you remember, when we met with the Special PSOP board, that's what happened.
So, Doug, this was like another literature review, the appendices.
That's all it was a literature review of selected literature, ignoring the primary documents and confirming what they already wanted done.
Okay.
That's what Naomi Harley did with the study for Rosker, the Oksapi study And we found out about that, if you remember, during the meeting at the White House in 1999.
Yeah.
When does it end? I mean, you know, the uranium missions are all over. We're attacking nations after nations, and we've got them in cruise missiles, bunker busters. We got the munitions used in the ones they're having the big debate on right now, all those things, the drones all over the place. We got them down 5.56, 7.62, 50 cal. We got the 20 millimeter, 25 millimeter, 30 millimeter. We got the 105, 120, and 125 millimeter. We got the cluster bombs, the ATEM and the PETEM. And again, the cluster bombs were used extensively all over. Again, they were used in the Balkans. And again, Pekka Vistra from the United Nations ordered Kilpatrick to clean that up, and he never did. We've got that because Pekka copied us on that, if you remember. And the whole thing. And then we got Somalia, which is all messed over. Because when we use uranium munitions in Somalia, that is exactly how the October 1993 medical order got out to do all of the medical care within the 72 hours. That is totally ignored. It continues. I mean, I don't know, and again, this is the other thing that bothers me, and I think this leads into the PTSD problems for everybody, the ethical moral dilemmas. We attack all these nations, again, whatever reason we have, but then we contaminate air, water, soil using illegal munitions. The other thing I found out, the Danville VA Medical Center, the brand new guy that was handling out the travel pay on Thursday, just got out as an Army Scout on Bradley fighting vehicles. He had never, quote, never received any of the mandatory training on depleted uranium at Fort Benning, and I know it was mandatory because I went to Benning, as you know, and set it up. He'd never seen the common task training on depleted uranium. And as you and I, we've continually heard that. How many times have we heard that wherever we've been for years?
Yeah.
It's not happening. We just deployed more from the Illinois Army National Guard. They didn't have any of the training. They're going in over into a totally contaminated area. Again, the on-site verification, the contamination. The other thing, if you remember, it's been even the British Royal Society has confirmed the contamination got into Northern Europe from Iraq and Somalia and the Balkans. So it's a horrific problem that doesn't seem to be going away. It's as if, and this is the thing that bothers me, the guys that have the responsibility could clean it up, end the nightmare, comply with their own regulations. Yes, I wrote it, our team wrote them, but General Shinseki signed them. And again, I'm calling publicly for General Shinseki and Colonel John Gingrich, Chief of Staff of the VA, to acknowledge this, provide the prompt and optimal medical care. Don't put everybody through the nightmare of trying to prove the stuff. When they have the exposures, they have it. Ensure that, you know, the Army, again, we have to come back, General, since you did it, and ensure the Army complies with the right order you signed, the regulations you signed as a general, even though you're Secretary of the VA. Well, Mikey and Craig, you guys are the ones that are up there with the buck now.
Okay, Doug, we're at 5:53. And some of the things that I want to mention is we talked about many things today. We talked about blogging, and blogging helps individuals, kind of a self-therapy, but you do a blog, bringing attention to your own suffering, to the own veteran. Then we talked about, you know, DU and problems there. So the issue continues, but I'm going to say a positive thing because I like to try to end up on a positive note. Is that since we started, when we came back home in 91, the system is broken. We knew it then. It's still broken, the backlog. But the important thing is that a lot of Gulf War veterans have gotten claims through, and at least they're getting some compensation. Yes, there's a backlog. It takes forever. You got to write it the right way. They are starting to pay attention. Only through our continued efforts and awareness will they do anything more. So everybody help us out. Find a way to help.
Thank you, Denise. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. The information will be available on the website for Progressive Radio Network and also in the other locations. Thank you very much, and God bless America. Thank you, Denise.
You're welcome. Bye.